Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of how bad things could get for Mitt Romney as the slow drip about his tenure at Bain Capital, how much money he made, what taxes he paid, and how much of his wealth has been hidden continues. Jacob Halbrun, the senior editor at The National Interest, joins us to discuss this, as well as news that Romney's biggest super PAC donor, Sheldon Adelson, might be in big trouble. Then we'll look into the jobs and job creator narrative that has been, and presumably will be again, a central issue in this year's presidential campaign. The editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly magazine, Paul Glastris, joins us to discuss how the lack of jobs did not create the great recession that has wiped out 40% of the average family's wealth, and that the campaign should be about how the middle class can get out from under ruinous debt and rebuild its wealth. Then finally, we will look into the firing of the head of North Korea's military and some of the recent surreal happenings in the Hermit Kingdom with Soo-mi Terry, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs on the National Security Council. She joins us to discuss miniskirts, Mickey Mouse, and the mysterious woman accompanying the boy emperor. Joining us now is Jacob Halbrun, who is senior editor at the National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times, a senior editor at the New Republic, and a Japan Society fellow. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob Halbrun.
Thanks, Ian.
And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Israel talking with senior leaders, and of course she represents an administration that the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is pretty much effectively at war with. There is no secret that Netanyahu is a very close friend of Mitt Romney's and has been for a long time, going back to their early days when they graduated from MIT and Harvard Business School, respectively. So I imagine there's discussions going on now have got to be a little surreal, haven't they?
Absolutely. And another thing that's come out is that when Mitt Romney was head of the U.S. Olympics Committee, he also outsourced the Olympic uniforms to Burma. I wouldn't call it a drip, but rather a flood of revelations about Romney's business dealings. And my strong suspicion is that this is just the beginning, and that the pressure will increase as well for Romney to release his tax records, which become more interesting each day he refuses to release them.
Well, I'd like to talk further about that, but I just wanted to get a sense of the Romney foreign policy, in as much as what I find extraordinary about, and since you wrote the book, They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons, and we know that Romney's almost entire foreign policy team are the neocons, and that I think in many ways Netanyahu's playing a far bigger role in the Romney campaign than is really recognized. But just to begin with, I find it extraordinary that a man could be running for president of the United States and literally have no apparent interest in foreign policy. He's been running for at least 10 years. He's not educated himself about the world and about foreign policy issues. And he simply believes that as CEO of America or CEO of USA Incorporated, he can simply outsource foreign policy to the neocons and outsource it to his Middle East policy to Benjamin Netanyahu.
It's true. And the other day he just had a fundraising dinner at Dick Cheney's house, talked about what a great man he is. The silver lining would be that since Romney doesn't appear to believe in anything except his own personal advancement, that he has simply taken the neocons on board and wouldn't listen to them once he's president. But given what occurred during the Bush presidency, I don't think it can be taken lightly that many of his advisors are, in fact, neoconservatives. And Romney has not only been belligerent on the question of Israel, but also declared that Russia was our number one geopolitical foe when he's not attacking China. So my guess is the Romney presidency probably would represent a wholesale reversion to the Bush policies and could well include a military strike on Iran.
And do you take seriously these reports that Condoleezza Rice is being considered as a vice president? We know that she wowed all of the big Republican donors at a recent retreat that Romney organized and the campaign organized in a ski resort in Utah. But, you know, her record is probably one of the most disastrous records of both a U.S. national security advisor and a secretary of state. If you really look at her record, she's got tremendous PR and apparently in Republican circles, she's highly regarded. But the record is quite to the contrary.
I agree. I think she would be a disastrous choice because it would make Obama's task all that much easier to portray Romney as simply Bush 2 or 3, that it would represent a return to the Bush era, both in domestic and in foreign policy. And I'd be amazed if Romney made that bold a choice and that reckless a choice. It seems to me he's more likely to pick someone like Portman from Ohio, a state that he needs desperately to win.
Well, that's a safe but extremely boring choice, as is Pawlenty.
Can't pick someone who would overshadow him, Romney.
Right. Well, that's I was about to say. That's why Chris Christie can't be the choice, right? Because he'll just make the second fiddle, make the number one man. He'll upstage him constantly, right?
Yeah, I mean, Christie is a true demagogue and an effective one, but also someone who has the ability to wade into a crowd, which Romney conspicuously lacks. And I think that's a good way of putting it, as you were earlier, that he outsources everything. And in a way, I think he views the presidency as something that he can sort of capture as a takeover artist in the way he did in business, and that the American people can be lulled into complacency, and that he would outsource much of the presidency, which is what George W. Bush did as well.
Well, I think what he's implying here is that I'm the management type and I'm going to manage America. And I would think that Obama could easily make the argument, and I don't know why he doesn't, that America needs a leader and we don't need a manager. The problems are so manifest that they're beyond management. We need, a bold leadership.
Yeah, I think, but that would require Obama to come up with his own plan, which he is not.
Sure.
So far, the campaign on both sides has been purely negative. But just tell me why Barack Obama is running to win re-election other than to stop the GOP from returning to power. What has he put forward? I really don't see the plan or even the visionary statement.
No, and in fact, there was I was speaking the other day to Amitai Etzioni, who said that, told me that there was a focus group of independent voters that CNN had organized, and they were all asked, what is the Republican narrative and the talking points? And everybody in the room could repeat verbatim what the Republicans have been saying on the stump. And then they said, what's the Democratic narrative? And there was this deathly silence.
Yeah, we don't know. And in that sense, Romney's critique of Obama is, of course, grossly exaggerated, but it is true that Obama has been a fairly passive and circumspect president over the past 4 years. I'm not saying that there haven't been, the health care was a major accomplishment, but again, that was one of those things where he pulled it out of the perils of Pauline at the last minute. We don't really see a coherent vision of how Obama would restore the American economy and what he would actually do.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Jacob Harburn, who is a senior fellow at, sorry, senior editor at the National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. And previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times, a senior editor at the New Republic, and a Japan Society fellow. So back to Romney's problems and the extent to which he's in a bind, largely of his own making, I think, where he either lied to the American people about his tenure at Bain and Capital when it ended, or he lied to the SEC. You think that drip, drip, drip is going to turn into a flood?
I do. And I think Romney would have been better off, obviously, addressing all of this during the primary season. And he should have said that he should have figured out some way, instead of these lawyerly evasions about his time at Bain, he would have had to say, yes, some outsourcing took place, but in the end, we ended up creating more jobs. Instead, he's running away from another one of his accomplishments, such as it is. The Bain Capital is his calling. It's supposed to be his calling card, and Obama has flipped that on him. Now he's desperately trying to defend his years at Bain and avoid any responsibility for many of the things that happened there. I think this could potentially be devastating for Romney.
And I imagine that the fact that he only released the 2010 returns is an indication that they were the least incriminating, and he doesn't want to go back like his father did. And Bill Clinton the other day mentioned that every president for the last 30 years has released decades worth of tax returns. John McCain released 20 years worth of tax returns. I imagine the years that are now in question about whether he was at the helm of Bain Capital, 1999 to 2002, those tax returns might well be incriminating.
Yeah, I suspect that it's so bad that, as George Will said, he's willing, the lesser hit is to be bludgeoned as he is being for not releasing them. The contrast with his father, again and again, is extremely striking because his father was progressive Republican, man of principle, who actually toured American ghettos and visited Appalachia as a candidate for the Republican nomination in 1968. Romney, the son, represents a repudiation of pretty much everything that his father stood for.
Well, is that though because of
George W. Bush did the took the opposite stances as his own father, but in Romney's case, it's just as extreme, if not even more.
So, but in both cases of the sons, distancing themselves or doing the opposite of what their fathers did, George W. Bush and H.W. Bush and Romney Jr. and Romney Sr., is that, though, to say how much the Republican Party has changed?
It's true, because I don't think that if you look at, unless you think that Romney was lying as governor of Massachusetts, which you can't discount, but he did come up with the version of Obama's health care plan, and his record was never that of a rabid conservative. And the Republican Party seems to have obviously drifted so far to the right that, there's this obviously this difficult dance between Romney and the far right. In the party. He's a candidate that I suspect some in the party would be just as happy to see lose in 2012 so that they can run a real firebrand in 2016 like Rick Santorum.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, let's turn Jacob Harburn to Sheldon Adelson, the biggest donor to super PACs supporting Mitt Romney, although we don't really know about the 501c4 super PACs and who's donating to them. And we know that, you know, corporate America is certainly putting money in there without any attribution. But Adelson apparently, and you've got to go back to again to the Netanyahu connection. Adelson, of course, has devoted his fortune to Netanyahu. He publishes a newspaper in Israel that's given away free. It's the biggest newspaper now in Israel devoted to Netanyahu. I believe that Netanyahu's been playing a role in the Romney campaign from the beginning, and there's no accident that Adelson first gave his money to Newt Gingrich to split the anti-Romney vote, which Gingrich did. And now we have reports coming out, I believe Frontline, PBS Frontline is doing an investigation into how much Adelson's in trouble. You know, Adelson, all the big super PAC donors, Adelson, the Koch brothers, and Simmons are all alumni, as it turns out, of Michael Milken, as is Romney himself. But in Adelson's case, these casinos in Macau apparently involved him. At least the suspicion is that he broke the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and could get nailed for it.
Yes, well, anyone operating in Macau, that would be like trying to play a football game without getting your uniform dirty. My suspicion is that, it seems pretty clear that Adelson will come under a lot of scrutiny. But the more, you know, we'll see what the investigation turns up. But what you're pointing at is the destructive influence that a number of elderly and wealthy American Jews have had on Israel and the relationship with America. And that's something that Peter Beinart talks about in his book, The Crisis of Zionism, that these elderly Jews have essentially practiced a form of checkbook Judaism, and that they have encouraged settlement growth in Israel, and that they poisoned the relationship between the Obama administration and Israel by demonizing Obama and thwarting the peace process.
Well, Jacob, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, but I thank you for joining us. And
thanks, Ian.
We should follow this further, I think, as more evidence emerges.
Absolutely.
Again, I've been speaking with Jacob Halbrun, who is a senior editor at the National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times, a senior editor at the New Republic, and a Japan Society fellow. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly magazine.
That's my money man down on his knees. He ain't praying, but a damn sure ought to be. He's in a place where money doesn't grow.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Glastras, who is the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly magazine. From September 1998 to January 2001, he was special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. And before joining the White House, he spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News & World Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Glastras.
Great to be here.
And the Washington Monthly has a cover article about the economic debate the candidates aren't having. Clearly, jobs are, and job creators, I guess, is the mantra on Romney's side. And the president, of course, is somewhat defensive because he hasn't been the miracle worker that the left expected of him and that the right are now castigating him for. Do you think his mistake, though, was earlier when he did not really go after the people who caused the devastation of the economy back in 2008? Because after all, it was the outrage over Wall Street that led to the foundation of the Tea Party, and they ran away with an issue that the Democratic Party left on the table.
Well, you know, he was on the horns of a dilemma back then. First, the prosecution of white collar crime of this sort is immensely difficult and can take years to do. And my understanding is, finally, with some pressure from U.S. attorneys. State attorneys, that there are some efforts now to begin those prosecutions. But at the time, remember, I think the concern within the White House from people at the Treasury that I talked to was, the house was on fire. The global economy was about to collapse. And the thing they needed to do was make sure the banking sector didn't take the economy down into the next Great Depression. So their number one focus was getting the banking sector from collapsing, and it was hard to do that and prosecute at the same time, and it was a thankless sort of thing. And it began, of course, with the bailout under President Bush in the fall of 2008. But then what the Obama administration did was very cleverly got the private sector to reinvest in the banks rather than the public having to put money in, and basically got the banks back on their feet and the economy beginning to create jobs a lot quicker than anyone thought was likely, and historically quicker and cheaper for the public than just about any similar kind of financial collapse in the past. So it was a heck of a feat, but politically it was a disaster for them.
And, of course, you have to add to that the fact that the bankers who we rescued are now giving all their money to Mitt Romney.
That's right, right. That's, no good deed goes unpunished, right? I mean, he had the audacity to actually blame the bankers whose hides he was saving for having caused the problem, and the bankers got their, took a great umbrage at this. And he bailed them out and ticked off the public, and then pointed out the facts of what the bankers did and then ticked them off too.
Well, in the Washington Monthly, Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly magazine, we're talking about the current issue that talks about the economic debate the candidates aren't having. You point out that the lack of jobs didn't cause a financial crisis, but what's really the albatross, if you will, around Clinton's neck and the American people's neck, if you will, is that the average family's wealth has declined 40% since 2007, according to the Federal Reserve. And it's worth noting that the 1% have done, almost as well in the opposite direction in terms of the plus side of the ledger. So why doesn't the president then tell us that? And why didn't he talk about that? The kind of kiss of death that to say how bad things are? I don't understand why you wouldn't really want to go back to this event that decimated the economy, the worst hit that's taken since the Great Depression. And it does at least tie into the narrative of the evisceration of the middle class, which I think it's starting to emerge, at least it seems to be, from the White House.
Well, I don't know why they wouldn't pick up on it. I think that there's probably a number of reasons, but let's just go back and agree. I think you rightly stated the thesis of our package of stories. It probably more than any other election that one can remember, this one seems to be about one thing, which is jobs. Right? Everyone says that the jobs numbers between now and November will determine who wins. Almost everything that Obama and Romney say in terms of their policies, whether to cut taxes or raise them on the wealthy or whatever, are done, in a way that argues that this will create jobs. But think about it this way: in 2007. Well, imagine that we could have 4.6% unemployment, right? Well, 4.6 unemployment, if we could get down to 4.6% unemployment, it would be astonishing considering where we are now. But 4.6% unemployment is what we had on the eve of the financial collapse, on the eve of the Great Recession. We had nearly full employment, and that didn't stop us from going into this collapse. So what was the cause of, or the precipitating cause anyway, of the fiscal collapse, financial collapse, was that the average American was already at that point tapped out. Levels of household debt had grown from 77% in 1990 to 127% by 2007, and savings rates had plummeted from 7% in that same period to zero. We had zero savings rate. And so what precipitated the Great Recession was people simply didn't have the savings or the money. People with jobs were not able to pay their mortgage. That's what did it. So getting back to 4.6% unemployment, which would be a godsend, doesn't necessarily get us to the kind of sustainable growth that we are used to in this country. So what we're arguing is that what we need to do is, and as you said, since the Great Recession, the average American has lost 40% of their savings, of their net wealth, largely in housing values. So we need to figure out ways of helping the average person save money for college, for retirement, to get them over a hump of unemployment, to be able to relocate to where the jobs are, to avoid bankruptcy and spinning out of control that happens to people's finances when they don't have a little savings. And let's go back to the Depression, Ian. We all think of the New Deal and what great things it did for the American people, and it certainly did in terms of putting people to work and building infrastructure that we're still using today. But it didn't lead to sustained economic growth. What led to sustained economic growth was what happened during World War II, and two things happened during World War II. First, we really did a stimulus bigger than anything FDR had done before that. Essentially, everyone who wanted work could have it, and people's incomes grew tremendously because of they had more and more hours of work. But B, they had nothing to spend the money on because of rationing, because of price controls. Store shelves were bereft. People could only spend so much. And also out of patriotism, they saved their money. They bought war bonds for several years. Well, at the end of the Depression, end of World War II, people thought we might plunge back into a depression, but we didn't. We had the beginnings of what turned out to be a several decade long post-war boom. And why? Because for the first time, the average American had savings. The average American was creditworthy. He could borrow money. He could tap that savings to buy a house, a car. It was on the backs of those assets that we created the post-war boom. So if we want to get back to those kinds of positive economic dynamics, we're just going to have to figure out ways of allowing people to do what people did in World War II, which is save more.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly magazine. He was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, and prior to that spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. Well, the IMF today, of course, came out with a report suggesting that by no means are we out of the woods vis-a-vis Europe, that shoe could drop, and that's always been something hovering over President Obama's re-election. You know, a lot of pundits have suggested that perhaps Angela Merkel controls his political fate more than Mitt Romney, and that's a shoe that still could drop. The other thing that the IMF warned about, of course, was the fiscal cliff that we're heading towards after the election. There is the sequester agreement that, interesting enough, if that were ultimately triggered, and I know that the Congress are going to work furiously to undo that, but it is the law. That could be an interesting change in Washington, actually forcing them to make decisions. That's all after the elections. Just in terms of the, again, because it's the election year and we tend to want to talk about this kind of stuff, in terms of teachable moments, there was a great teachable moment from a TED talk that an entrepreneur, Nick Hanauer, gave. He was the single biggest non-family investor in Amazon, very wealthy fellow who absolutely exploded the myth of the job creator. And he basically said that the wealthy businessmen don't create jobs. They only demand, only when people have money in their pockets and buy products that capitalists make, do you hire people. You don't hire them out of altruism, you hire them out of necessity. I've always thought this was a very, very powerful piece. And assuming that Mitt Romney survives the kind of vulture capitalist attacks on him now, still the president hasn't gone after this complete canard about the job creator.
Well, the president has been making a broader point that I think addresses what the entrepreneur was saying and you're saying. And that is, what he'll say is, we don't grow economies from the top down. That's what the Republicans believe. But what he believes is you grow economies from the middle out, that you have a strong middle class, strong grassroots, and you grow it out that way. And so what we have with, the term job creator, right, is, another brilliant Republican formulation that is a euphemism for wealthy, right? A job creator, they just redefine wealthy people as job creators. Certainly the money that wealthy people have can be invested in firms and so forth, and that's important. But, the vast majority of small businesses are not financed by rich guys. They're financed by whoever the entrepreneur can get to put money in. That could be their brother and their parents and the local bank and their friends and their credit cards. And we've seen in the current issue of the Washington Monthly, there's a story about some fresh numbers that we've derived from federal data about the declining number of new startup businesses, especially in the last 10 years, but really going back 30 years. And, what might be some of the sources of that decline? So when people don't have savings, this gets back to the issue of savings and wealth. When average people don't have savings, they can't invest in their own small businesses or in other people's small businesses. So the job creators that the Republicans talk about, they've done very well over the last 10 years, but they haven't created a lot of jobs.
Well, I guess it's what's just happening now with the president, who seems to have turned around, and he was being criticized a lot by a lot of disappointed progressives and liberals who thought he had sort of wimped out in the face of really venomous attacks and constant attacks from the Republicans. It seems like he's asserting himself a little bit more on the campaign trail. So just in closing, do you think that we're going to have a stronger narrative if it gets back to the jobs issue, which is the big centerpiece, that he'll have a stronger narrative and perhaps educate us a little bit more about some of these realities that we've been talking about?
I mean, I think that's what we're seeing. I think since really September of last year, I think he had a little bit better hand that he could play, and he felt it was, he had the debt crisis behind him. The Republicans finally agreed to not shut down the government and downgrade our credit. He finally, that was a miserable position for him to be in, and there wasn't much he could have done about it. That was done, and suddenly, he had the cards, and I think he's been playing them masterfully since then, and especially in recent weeks. So I think the answer is he is developing a narrative. There's still plenty of time between now and November. I don't think this is going to be a cakewalk of election. I think, he's still an uphill battle against expectations and a very, very, very weak economy. But I certainly see a better narrative being developed.
Well, Paul Glastras, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Ian, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly magazine. He was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, and before joining the White House was 10 years as correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about some surreal news coming out of North Korea.
Got a nightlife, lost his day job, pushing paper, swinging pendulums, anything to serve a function or to occupy some time. You gotta earn this living somehow. You're good as dead without a bank account. But it's funny how a lot you fell down in that unemployment line with all that trash.
Who's the leader of the front to take for you and me? M-I-C-K-E-Y, M-O-U-S-E.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a national intelligence fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former deputy national intelligence officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sumi Terry.
Thank you.
And there's quite a bit of mystery surrounding the dismissal or the supposed illness of Vice Marshal Ri Yong-ho, who is pretty much the mentor of the young leader in North Korea. I take it that the illness is a cover story, that he was essentially purged.
Yes, that is correct. And this removal of Ri Yong-ho is quite significant. I think a lot of North Korea experts suspected this even by April, when Yi was not awarded any promotions at the party's conference. So some experts, North Korea experts, thought that was a sign that Yi Hong's future was already in doubt back in April. He was a powerful figure, Yi Hong-ho, as you said, who was a very close friend of his Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il. And he was a powerful figure who helped with the succession transition for Kim Jong-un. He, along with two other people, Kim Kyung-hee, his aunt, and his uncle-in-law, Jang Sung-taek, he was only one out of the three guys who really helped Kim Jong-un succession transition. So this is quite significant, and I see it as a purge.
So you mentioned April was his last appearance, and he didn't get I think it might have been his last appearance, but he didn't get the promotion expected. Would that have had something to do with the failed missile launch or the satellite launch?
I am not sure that if that it's connected to that. I don't know. And you know, who really knows why he was removed? But we know that it's definitely not because he was ill. First of all, he had no signs of illness that we know about. And besides, even when all the North Korean officials are usually in poor health, they usually stay in their post. This is unusual. We do not know what the reason was behind his removal, what the disagreement was, why he was removed. It's probably Kim Jong-un's attempt to sort of strengthen his hold on the military and the regime, and maybe as a warning to the military and the party officials and anyone who could potentially represent a potential threat to his authority, that, you know, is to show that someone like him, Ri Yong-ho, can be removed as, again, childhood friend of Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un's own mentor, that what does it mean for others? So I think it's a warning, but we don't know what's behind the disagreement that led to this.
So, Sumi Terry, on the other side, if you will, the civilian side of things, as opposed to the military side, and there's no question that from the very beginning, Kim Jong-un reiterated the Songun military first policy. But a lot of Korean watchers are quite fascinated by the mysterious woman that shown up at his side yes. On state television at a music concert and visiting a kindergarten. That's not keeping with tradition, I take it, in terms of the previous, the father and the grandfather. The women were pretty invisible in those days, weren't they?
No, that is true. And it does seem like Kim Jong-un has a different leadership style. He's clearly more comfortable, you know, in his own skin than his father was. He gives public speeches and so on. I don't know. Maybe North Korea has hired some sort of a consulting or PR firm that we do not know about. There's definitely interesting PR blitz coming out of the country. It seems like all the images and pictures and all these speeches are just, it is very different. In terms of women, it probably reflects that his generation. He's only 28. Possibly 29 years old, and, you know, who wants to see these ladies all covered up, right? So, on this concert, apparently there are various women wearing shorter skirts and sleeveless dresses, which is a big no-no in North Korea.
Well, that fashion statement combined with the appearance of Mickey Mouse at this concert with these young women in miniskirts playing violins, etc., has certainly gotten people all worked up. But isn't it a bit of an irony that Mickey Mouse, obviously the Walt Disney Company, you're not getting any royalties there. Wasn't that the reason why, in many ways, why Kim Jong-un ended up being the successor? The other brother who was expected to be the successor, didn't he get arrested sneaking into Japan to visit Disneyland, right?
That is really, I am quite fascinated by Kim family's fascination with Disney. Yes, it is absolutely true that Kim Jong-nam, Kim Jong-un's oldest son, got into big trouble after he tried to sneak into Japan with his family, with his girlfriend or mistress or wife, with a couple kids, and he tried to visit Tokyo Disneyland using fake passport from either Dominican Republic or some other Latin American country. And that effectively ended his chances of succeeding Kim Jong-il, because until then, which was, I think that was 2001, until then, he was in line to succeed Kim Jong-il. But after that fiasco, Kim Jong-il reportedly got very upset, and that just effectively ended his chances.
Again, I'm speaking with Sumi Terry, a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a national intelligence fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former deputy national intelligence officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. So there's something a little surreal about our conversation so far, but that's the nature of this regime. What I find, I don't know whether you've ever seen the way the people on South Park, the comedy routine, deal with them, but in many ways I think there's probably some of the most accurate portrayals of this strange family. But what I find fascinating about the way that Western analysts deal with North Korea, with the exception of a few, that they talk about it as this communist, Stalinist state in all of those kind of Cold War terms. And my understanding is, particularly from scholars like Brian Myers, that we've got it wrong, that this is not a left-wing government as such. Their ideology is not so much important as the dynastic hold that this family has. And the only way to understand that is to understand Imperial Japan. And that's the better analogy, that this young boy emperor that's running North Korea now and asserting himself is rather in the tradition, more in the tradition of a right-wing Japanese pre-war emperor than a communist leader. What's your...
No, that is absolutely correct. And it's not only Imperial Japan, but Imperial Korea, Imperial Joseon Dynasty. This is truly, and also Kim Il-sungism, Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-ilism, which is sort of unique system that they have going. But I absolutely agree with that. It's not really, you shouldn't really look at North Korea from a communist lens per se. It's truly a unique country. This is the only country that has third hereditary succession. The only two other leaders that North Koreans have known are Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, and now Kim Jong-un, this 28, 29-year-old boy, a boy king, who has not served a day in the military, and has, you know, he's a four-star general and so on. So I think that is a correct way of looking at it. It is truly a unique place that's quite hard to understand.
Well, one of the things that the North Korean media are saying now, and I wonder if there's any truth to it, you know, in deifying these leaders, they build statues all over the place. And then at the time when the missile launch back in April failed, they unveiled two huge statues of Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung. And apparently they also have carved a massive 400-foot-long wide swath across a natural rock face to mark Kim Jong-il's birthday back in February. And apparently throughout the country, they've carved these messages in adoration to the dynasty on cliff faces, etc., in this kind of form of what nationally sanctioned graffiti, I guess. It's a strange thing. But what the North Korean media are now reporting is that the South Koreans have sent agents in to deface some of these statues. Is there any truth to that?
I don't think it's South Korean agents. North Koreans have been facing with its own, you know, the public, there's a little bit more awareness in North Korea as information is at least slowly slipping in. And I believe it's probably their own disgruntled, some of disgruntled North Koreans versus South Korean agents. But of course, this is how North Korean media would spin it.
So that means then that people inside that regime don't buy this cradle-to-grave Juche philosophy and incredible propaganda and incredible worship of the leader, the dear leader, the great leader.
Well,
and now
great majority of people do, but that's not complete, and there is a chip in that that pillar of the information control and then ideological indoctrination. There are cracks to that where now information is going through from China to North Korea, and more public is aware that this more, not all, but still more than before, people are aware that this this indoctrination and this what they're hearing from the regime is not the 100% truth. And they are now more listening to South Korean pop songs, music, shows, the videos, soap operas, movies. They come in through the defectors and through the border from China, and more people are aware of this. And this may be a sign where Kim Jong-un himself, he decided to watch this, all these Disney characters, to sort of switch to change, because he is very much aware of the public mindset that it is changing. And there have been signs in the past before where there are people who did, you know, make graffitis on the Korean won, or, you know, have a little bit here and there. And of course, if you get caught, you'll be sent to a political prison camp and be in massive trouble. But there are more people who are aware, and we have been seeing signs of discontent, at least still a small level. It's not going to be like Arab Spring type of thing. But still, there's more information coming in now.
So I think wouldn't it therefore be reasonable to conclude, Sue Mi Terry, that there has been some incidents, some statues have been defaced, and that the way that the North Koreans are spinning it is that they've had to acknowledge it, and therefore the propaganda machine is blaming it on the South. Otherwise, why mention it?
Exactly. No, that's exactly what they're doing. Is they have to talk about it because it is happening, and of course, you know, the easiest people to blame are South Koreans.
So
instead of admitting it's their own people, of course.
Right. So, Sumi Terry, explain to me, though, why there's enormous sympathy in South Korea for the North, and a lot of people in the South, and when I've interviewed people that have been critical, like Brian Myers, who've been critical of the North at the time of the sinking of the warship and the shelling of the island, etc., I get angry mail from people who think we're all being told lies and that North Korea is not as bad as it's portrayed. And apparently that is fairly pervasive in the South. And so what explains it? I mean, I think the shelling of the island, I think, woke up a lot of people in South Korea. But I recall at the time of the sinking of the warship, there's still an awful lot of people in South Korea who believed the North Korean version of it, and that felt that it was just South Korean propaganda.
Yes, first of all, it's quite complicated. But yes, with the sinking of the Cheonan ship, believe it or not, 50% of the Korean people still are not sure, and they believe that their own government came up with sort of, you know, made up the evidence or so on, which is really hard to believe, as you said. But shelling of the Yeompyeong Island really was a game changer in that they were, as the shelling unfolded in front of them and they were watching it on television, there was no denying the North Koreans were doing this. So that did have an effect on South Korean public's mind. So now going forward, I believe that if North Koreans really push it, if there's another incident such as that, I think South Korean public will be less willing to, you know, support North Korean cause, or be more willing to be a little bit more hardline. So that Yeomtong Island incident was a game changer in that. But to answer your question, that really has to do with a lot of factors. But first of all, there was a whole decade of sunshine policy in South Korea, where the government leadership was much more sympathetic to the North Korean regime. And that went on for 10 years. And during that 10 years period of time, there was a sort of a shift in mindset, in the public's mind. And also, you have to remember that North Koreans and South Koreans are, you know, they come from the same people. My own family, my entire paternal side came from North Korea. So my grandfather, grandmother, and my aunts and uncles, and they all came from North Korea. And these are really same people with the same language, same culture, same heritage, same. So it's, you know, they have tendency to sympathize with the North Korean people and the suffering of the North Korean people.
Well, but why? There's one thing to have sympathy for the suffering of the North Korean people, but it's another thing to believe to disbelieve the aggressive nature of the Korean regime. It has one of the biggest armies in the world, and we know that a lot of the food aid goes to a country that can't feed its own people because of its totally screwed-up policies.
Right, it has always been the case. That's why I really point to the whole 10 years of the sunshine policy under Kim Dae-jung and Noh Myon presidents. Before that, if you remember, during the Park Chung-hee era of 1961 to 1979, North Koreans were considered evil and hard and all, so on. There was their own South Korean indoctrination and in the education system in terms of portraying North Korea as the evil country. And that went on from Park Chung-hee regime presidency to Chun Doo-hwan presidency and so on. But so it was really a decade of during the Sunshine Policy, when South Korea was exercising Sunshine Policy, that there was a shift in Korean people's thinking.
So in other words, what's happened here is that the early South Korean governments, the military governments, were
much more hardline, yes.
And their propaganda was so crude, right, that it led to the deep sort of skepticism that the public has towards the government. And you're saying that that's changed somewhat, though, since the shelling of the island.
Yes, since the shelling of the island, there was just no denying it. Just that whole thing unfolded as they were all watching. You know, South Korean public was, they were fixated on television. They were all watching on television as their island was getting shelled and their citizens got killed. And that really did put damper on things. And now I don't think Korean public would be as easily would just say, okay, you know, at next provocation we should just deal with. Let them just continually act this way. I think South Koreans would be more inclined to now say we have to react and stop such provocation.
So do you think that we'll be having a similar conversation again in a year or 6 months? Over the years, I've talked to Korean experts, and you always end up saying, well, you know, will there be change? And sometimes people say, well, yes, maybe, maybe not.
There's not going to be much of a change. This whole cycle has been going on for a very long time, and I'm afraid that it's going to continue. I'm not quite surprised by almost anything. Even when you think about provocation, we tend to think our North Korea's provocation has been extreme in the recent years and so on with nuclear tests and missile tests. But you have to remember that North Korea's provocation was a lot worse way back when. North Koreans have completely, remember the terrorist attack against the South Korean airliner. North Koreans blew up a South Korean airliner, killing hundreds of people. North Korea, with a bomb in Myanmar where it blew up half of the South Korean cabinet. I mean, North Koreans are used to conducting this kind of acts for decades and having gotten away with it. South Korean government did not react to, North Koreans tried to assassinate South Korean President Park Chung-hee and ended up killing his wife, First Lady. And, you know, so my point is you have to put their escalations and their provocative actions in historical context. And they've been doing this for a very long time, and they have always gotten away with it, and I don't see why they would change now. And I certainly don't think that it would change even under Kim Jong-un. And I would warn people from reading too much into these recent gestures and symbols, Disney characters, into thinking that somehow North Korea would suddenly liberalize or abandon its nuclear weapons or, ready to join the international community. I hate to be a pessimist, but I don't see much changing in the next, in any time near future.
Well, just in closing, Sumi Terry, what about the cracks in the regime? You mentioned videotapes. My understanding is that South Korean soap operas are very popular in North Korea. They bootleg them, and so much so that the North Korean security people keep turning off the power, although they have regular power outages at any rate, and they go to homes and the videotapes get jammed in the in the players. That's one of the techniques they use to. And you know that there's a lot of smuggling going on the Chinese border. A lot of people are sneaking out. More people are sneaking out. It does seem that at least there are some cracks there. And if there are some people inside the country that haven't been brainwashed to the extent that they're defacing monuments of the dynasty. Are these just anecdotal?
They are anecdotal, but you're absolutely correct. And I say there are roughly four pillars to regime stability, how regime remains stable despite of everything that's going on. And they are, from foreign assistance to pervasive security apparatus to ideological indoctrination and monopoly on information. These are pillars of stability. And there are cracks to all the pillars of stability. Right now, in terms of foreign aid, the South Korean government has not been giving any kind of foreign aid. There is the security service is not as effective as before because now there's a lot of corruption and you can pay off these or bribe these security guards so defectors can, defect from North Korea. Ideological indoctrination is not as strong as before or pervasive as before. And certainly on monopoly on information, as you said, there are definite cracks as these unwanted information is coming into North Korea through China's North Korea border. Movies, DVDs, and CDs, they're all getting smuggled in. And as you said, North Koreans are huddled together, and watching these movies illegally and listening to radio stations and so on. But that said, I don't think even this is enough to see any kind of, there will be any kind of a public uprising as some might expect, as something like Arab Spring. I still think if there's going to be any kind of instability in North Korea, it's going to come from top, it'll be top down versus bottom up. It will have to come from the elites.
Well, I think
potential factional struggle, because elites are the ones that's keeping the system going. It's the elite support for the regime that makes that aids the stability of the country. We have to remember during the famine years in mid-1990s when millions of people died because of famine. North Korean government did not care about that. It doesn't. So it really doesn't matter what the public is going to do or not do. If there's going to be any kind of real trouble with the North Korean system, it has to come from the elites. Disgruntled discontent from the elites, I mean.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Sumi Terry.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sumi Terry, a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a national intelligence fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former deputy national intelligence officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs on the National Security Council. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.